Good evening, everybody. It's Dwayne McFarlane back with another episode of the RSP Fantasy Film and Data. As always, joined by the best film breakdown guy in the business, at least on Twitter, Jay. That's you. How are you doing, buddy?
Oh, man, that's high praise. I don't know if I've quite earned it just yet. There are a lot of people out there doing really great work. Listeners, we took a little hiatus for Thanksgiving, but Dwayne and I are very excited to get back at it. Fantasy playoffs starting off. We're going to touch on some, very interesting players today. So let's go ahead and get it going, Dwayne.
Yeah, before we jump into any players, I have to ask, you know me, I live in Dallas. I'm a big Cowboys fan. Very, very frustrating team this season. I'm just wondering, Jay, you know, what have you seen? You know, if you listen to the local media here, the pervasive themes you continue to hear is that, you know, the talent is there, but it's just an issue with coaching is why, you know, Dallas is so inconsistent. So, you know, we got the game coming up tonight. I just thought I'd throw that out there to you off the top. What are your thoughts about Dallas, and what have you seen?
Yeah, you know, I agree with your take that they're a very talented roster on offense and defense. You know, Prescott, Elliott, and Cooper, obviously very skilled, out there as the skill guys, but then also a very good offensive line. And then on defense, you know, with DeMarcus Lawrence, Jaylon Smith, Leighton Vander Esch, who's obviously, you know, injured right now, but even Sean Lee is a very good linebacker. And then they have some pretty good defensive backs out there in the secondary. So, you know, 6-6 and maybe the worst division in football is definitely surprising. And I think what I've noticed about Jason Garrett, you know, aside from the scheme stuff, and there's a lot of critique, especially of their offense in terms of their offensive scheme and forcing, you know, runs to Ezekiel Elliott, forcing touches, et cetera, whether that's the most efficient approach. To me, it seems like it's a lot of the sort of overall, you know, high level stuff with being a head coach, the organization, you know, picking up on every edge. When you see him interviewed, you know, about fourth down decisions, which Jason Garrett tends to be very conservative. You know, he often says he goes with his gut. He's sort of derided for not knowing the analytics, knowing the odds of going for it in certain situations. You know, they'll do things like, you know, they're down 7 points with 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter and they're punting from their own 40-yard line. And you're like, well, I don't know if that's the best move there. And then, you know, you see last week when they play the Patriots, just murdered them on special teams. Offensively, defensively, the teams were pretty evenly matched, but the Patriots just had such a big edge in, you know, the small things about playing football, you know, the special teams, the details, procedural penalties, et cetera. And to me, I've seen no indication from Garrett that he's really on top of all the detail, you know, has that attention to detail that a coach like Bill Belichick or other great coaches like Sean Payton have, where you know and you can see that they're doing everything they can to get a winning edge in every aspect of the game. And that's really the head coach's job. So that's the main thing I've noticed.
Yeah, it's interesting. The special teams were definitely a major problem against, you know, the Patriots. But, you know, them coming out, going down the field, the first drive against Buffalo, getting 7 points, spreading the ball around. You got Amari Cooper involved in the game early. You know, it looked like, you know, things were going their way, and it just seems like it's, either it's an ill-timed penalty or Dak holding onto the ball maybe a tad too long, in which Dak's really played well this season. I wouldn't, you know, if I were to have to pick somewhere to place a lot of this blame, yeah, Dak has had some games where he definitely contributed to the loss, but he's also a part of the reason why they were actually in the game to begin with. But it just seems like at the worst times, you know, there's a, you know, hold on the ball a tad too long, you have a fumble, you've got some sort of penalty. Like you said, you know, you've got some sort of special teams error where you get a, you know, your punt blocked, or, you know, you don't advise your kick returner, Tony Pollard, to move up despite, you know, three short kicks already in the game, two of which had already almost been fumbled to the Patriots. You know, there were other plays in that game, you know, Jay, where Randall Cobb had a fumble where it came back to him. Blake Jarwin had a fumble where it actually came back to him. It could have even been worse against the Patriots. But just one other quick question for you on this. So, I mean, we hear the example Bill Belichick all the time. You hear Sean Payton. But why aren't more coaches good at this. Why does Bill Belichick have the market so cornered when it comes to, I mean, he's literally on a pedestal by himself. I wouldn't even put Sean Payton on his level. I mean, what does he do that's so different that allows, and you may not have the answer to this, obviously it's a, it's a big question, but I know a lot of folks wonder, it's just amazing to me that he can be so much better than everyone else.
Well, I mean, you know, when you see Bill Belichick interviewed, if he gets a good, solid football or strategical question, you know, his answer is just the level of thought that goes into everything that he's doing. I mean, really, to me, it just gets down to that attention to detail with everything. You know, he mentioned in discussing the blocked punt that New England had, you know, he's talking about, oh, the wind is blowing from one direction of the field to the other. So we figured the punter would probably punt it to his left. So we sent pressure off the left side. And, you know, I'm someone who's been obviously not in an official capacity, but been, you know, really interested and passionate about football my entire life. And I've never once heard anyone else mention that as something to consider on a punt. And you're like, you know, this guy's going 5, 6, 7, 8 levels deep in terms of his attention to detail. And, you know, when you learn about Bill Belichick, it's just really that he's just had a passion for football his entire life and is just constantly consuming educational material on any offensive system, defensive system, you know, football strategy. And he really just has an encyclopedic knowledge of those things and, you know, is obviously able to translate that knowledge into, you know, composed, informed decision making, both in practice and then also, you know, executing that same those same decisions on Sundays. So it's really impressive. And I mean, just speaks to who he is and, you know, his passion for football, you know, that really has embodied his whole career. So very impressive. I don't know if there's an easy answer for how someone can replicate it.
Yeah. It's amazing.
A lot of hard work.
I think it's something, you know, that we'll look back on, you know, and I don't know that anyone will be able to duplicate, you know, what he's done, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, even when you look at how coaching promotions work, you know, it's usually the coordinators, you know, the hot coordinators at the time because of the scheme and those traits, you know, having knowledge of a specific offensive scheme is just such a small slice of the pie of what it takes to be a head coach. When you start talking about, you know, people management, you know, planning practices, planning, you know, offseason training sessions, you know, hiring your assistant coaching staff, you know, there's just so many more things that go into being a head coach than just the scheme. And, you know, those coaches that excel in the scheme are the ones that are promoted to the jobs. So the educational process, the promotional process for coaches doesn't necessarily lend itself well to developing good head coaches.
Yeah. Well, speaking of excelling, let's jump over into some players and not excelling. Let's talk about a few players, you know, just a few months ago, if we think about, you know, fantasy drafts, let's talk about a few runners first. And we'll start with Derrick Henry. You know, this is a guy that you could get in the fourth and fifth rounds of most fantasy drafts, Jay. He's a guy that I was very cold on just based on the way that he does get used, which, you know, most of his production comes in these games where, you know, Tennessee is winning. Anytime Tennessee gets into a neutral game script or a trailing game script, his usage, you know, tends to go down. You know, that trend is not completely gone away, and it's not so much about a guy like Deion Lewis coming on the field and getting touches, but it is about, you know, Deion Lewis coming on the field and getting snaps. But if you look at, you know, Derrick Henry just over the last several weeks, I mean, he's a guy that's probably, you know, if you've got him on your fantasy team and you are anywhere close to making the playoffs, he's put you into the playoffs because week 9 in a PPR format, 25 points, week 10, 33 points, week 12, 31 points. And then last week he scored 26 points. So he's averaging 19 points on the season. Before that, it had been 17, 12, 12, 14, 4, 18, 9. So he's on a real hot streak right now. I mean, and then if you look at, you know, the margins of victory, you know, for, you know, the Titans in these games, most of these games that I'm talking about, so they won by 17 points correlated with 26 points. You win by 13 points, he's got 31 points. You got a game where they win by 3 points. He gets 33 points. You got a game that you lose by six, so you're still within a touchdown. You know, he gets 25 points. So over these last several games, Tennessee's been able to keep the game scripts, you know, really close. And that's been, you know, a good thing whenever it comes to Derrick Henry and his production. So what are your thoughts on Derrick Henry? What are you seeing? You know, obviously, you know, his yards after contact, as you would expect, they're big. You know, he's getting 4.11 yard, 4.9 yards per carry, Jay. 4.1 of those come after contact. You know, he's avoiding a tackle on 20% of his carries, which is, you know, right around the league average. You know, so it's not like he's eluding a lot of tacklers, but he is constantly gaining yardage moving forward. You know, he's got 229 fantasy points, so he's the fourth ranked fantasy running back. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on him, you know, where he's at, you know, in his, you know, career arc with the things that you're seeing. And do we think he's a guy that's around to stay? We're going to have to, you know, think more about next year as we go into fantasy drafts, or, you know, is he a guy that continues to have a limited skill set? What do you think about Derrick Henry?
Well, Dwayne, I've never been a huge fan of Henry. You know, if you've seen my work on the RSP and Twitter, I focus a lot on, you know, sort of the conceptual foundations of running back play, a lot of, you know, the craft of running back play, rather than just, you know, picking the big fast guys. And I think Henry, you know, may be the supreme, at least big guy, and, you know, he's still pretty fast in the NFL. And I think just, you know, one thing that stood out to me through his career is as the season wears on, he seems to get better and better. And, you know, defenses accrue injuries, players are banged and bruised. He's just an Iron Man. You know, you go back to his college days when he's getting 30, 40 carries a game at Alabama. You know, he's never really had any significant injury history. He's just a tank. He doesn't wear down, and he gets against these worn out defenses at the end of the year. And you have this huge, fast running back who is very adept at breaking tackles. You know, he has very long limbs, a good stiff arm. He's good at, you know, avoiding leg contact by using his upper body to ward off defenders. And, you know, once the defenders slow down and you're not getting guys gang tackling, he breaks a tackle or two, and he has very good speed to take it to the house. And, you know, you saw that last year against Jacksonville where he just embarrassed them. And, you know, he's starting to do the same thing this year. So that's really, you know, what I think about Henry. I would say, you know, over the past 4 weeks, he's really taken off. You know, he's been somewhat consistent the whole year, but, you know, they faced some pretty bad run defenses, Carolina, Jacksonville, Kansas City, and Indianapolis. So, you know, not necessarily tearing up a murderer's row in terms of run defenses. So just something to pay attention to as we go forward. And, you know, you have a running back, and this is something that I've noticed as I've studied running backs more and more, is if you don't have, you know, disciplined reads, disciplined footwork, you know, going through a proper process as a back, often these guys will have success against, you know, run defenses that aren't as strong. You know, the good athletes will have more success against those type of defenses. But then when they go against the really good defenses, they can struggle a bit. And, you know, Henry doesn't always read it right. He doesn't always have balanced footwork. He often struggles against penetration. So, you know, as you go through his career, he may struggle more against those good run defenses than a running back like Dalvin Cook, who is very sound in, you know, all of the skill factors of running back play, and, you know, is often more resistant to bad matchups.
Yeah, it is interesting when you look at the last two seasons. You know, over the last 3 weeks, you know, you've had 188, 159, and 149 rush yards the year before. And a similar span in the season, you mentioned the Jacksonville game. So 238 yards, 170 yards, 84 yards, and 93 yards to close out last season. So definitely, you know, he is someone that has, you know, done well towards the end of the season. It's not that he's done bad this year. I mean, his yards each game, 84, 82, 44, 100, 78, 28, 90, 75, 63. So, I mean, he's actually been better, you know, as far as at least getting around, you know, the 70 yard mark every game, you know, this season versus last year. You know, in the Titans, you know, if you look at, you know, their schedule and the way that things have played out, most of their games have been fairly close. They've had a few games that have gotten out of hand on them. But now, in these last couple of weeks, like you said, the matchups have been good. So Kansas City was obviously a great matchup. That's 188 yards. Jacksonville last week was another, or the week before last was a solid matchup, 159 yards. He just loves playing Jacksonville. And then you have Indianapolis, which has actually had been a pretty good run defense, but Tennessee got out ahead of them. You know, they won the game 31-17. So there was plenty of opportunity for attempts, 26 attempts for 149 yards. But what's interesting about Henry is, you know, in games where they're winning and the defense, the opposing defense is expecting run, you know, he still averages really well as far as his yards per carry, where a lot of times, you know, runners that are getting those extra 10 carries a game because their team is ahead, you'll notice their yards per carry a lot of times will actually go down unless they break a big run, because the opposing defense is actually just expecting you to try to run the clock out. So they start stacking the box and doing different things. But with Henry, for whatever reason, that seems to lead to these, you know, really big plays.
Yeah, you know, I think that, well, first of all, to those defenses that you mentioned, you know, I just looked it up, Football Outsiders, DVOA. Carolina is the 32nd ranked run defense in terms of DVOA. Jacksonville's 31. Kansas City's 30. Mm-hmm. So the three worst rush defenses by DVOA. And then, you know, you have Indianapolis, who's 21st. So definitely matchups conducive to running backs excelling. Derrick Henry, you know, when you mention his ability to close out games, and I think a lot of times these psychological factors are, you know, derided in terms of football commentary, but, you know, human psychology is a real thing, and having been around the game, you know, played the game, coach players for 7 years, you know, players saying, I don't want to tackle this guy is a real thing. And I, you know, I've seen it happen, you know, not at an NFL level, never been around those guys, but I wouldn't be surprised if when teams are losing and, you know, the Titans are running out the clock and you see, you know, 250-pound Derrick Henry running at you, there's a little bit inside of you that's saying, man, I really don't want to tackle this guy for the 25th time this game. And I wouldn't be surprised if that has something to do with his success, both late in the season and then also late in games. And then, you know, just speaking more to his fantasy potential, the thing about Henry is the Titans have a strong offensive line. They have an offense that they want to run the ball. You know, you already went over their numbers in terms of their frequencies, especially when they're even or ahead, they want to run the ball. And then when they're down in the red zone, you know, no one else on that team is getting goal line carries. Derrick Henry is going to get all the goal line carries. So essentially, you know, every rushing touchdown that they have from a running back is going to be by way of Derrick Henry's legs. So, you know, it's really a situation that's conducive to really good production. And Derrick Henry, you know, he's probably, like I said, the supreme size, speed, you know, prospect at running back in the NFL.
Yeah, he and Fournette, but Fournette's had the ankle issues. So what are your thoughts? You know, like, I'm just sitting here now, you know, and I'm already starting to reflect some as far as next year. Obviously, if you've got Derrick Henry on your fantasy team, you don't need us to tell you you're going to be starting him, you know, in your fantasy playoffs. But as you start thinking, you know, you start gearing up for next year, you know, is Henry, because this year Henry's a guy that I had sitting, you know, like running back 18, 16, somewhere in there. I can't remember exactly where you had him. I know we talked about him, but is he a guy that you see liking more next year, or do you think you're going to have some of the same concerns?
You know, you always start to worry when guys are building up, or, you know, get thinning the tread on their tires in terms of running back play. So you always have to worry about injury with a guy who's just been, you know, such a carry hog for his whole career, you know, even, as I said, dating back to his days at Alabama. But unless they add some kind of significant, you know, additional running back, you have to assume that he's going to have a similar role. I don't see Tennessee changing up its coaching staff. You know, they have a first year offensive coordinator who has done a pretty decent job, especially once Ryan Tannehill's gotten some action. So I don't think they'll change, you know, their offensive play calling staff. And assuming the situation doesn't change, then I don't see any reason why, you know, you wouldn't consider Derrick Henry, you know, top five running back heading into 2020.
Well, let's talk about another guy, and this is a little bit opposite, right? So Derrick Henry's a guy that you could have got, you know, in the mid rounds, and he's performing now like a guy that, you know, if we were to draft today, a lot of folks might consider taking Derrick Henry in the first round of a fantasy draft. But let's talk about Saquon Barkley. Obviously, you know, some of this is due to injury. He's missed a few games. You know, he might be a little nicked up. You have Barkley sitting at running back 17 in a PPR format, you know, was quite often the number one pick, you know, in a fantasy draft this summer. If he wasn't, he was probably the number two. And so, you know, this is a guy that if you looked at him, you know, one of the things I talked about in the preseason, you know, Jay, and I know you've talked about the style of Barkley, is Barkley really relied a lot on the big plays. Last year, over 54% of his yards came after 15 yards. And, you know, his breakaway, you know, per attempt, you know, was really high last season. And right now, this year, if you look at, you know, his same percentages for those things, 26% of his yards have come after 15 yards. So 144 yards versus last year, 700 of his yards came that way. And so he's only breaking away. He's only getting a 15 yard or more carry on 3.6% of his attempts, which is below the league average. Last year, he actually led the league in that category as far as big plays go. So Barkley is a guy that we know some of why he's ranked 17 is due to missing time. But there's also a performance issue. Something's going on here, you know, that's different with Barkley. And just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Any thoughts around, you know, the explosiveness, his ability to break the big plays, and any insights? I know that we may have talked about this a little in the past, but, you know, to his style and why that may be more problematic for a back like him.
Well, again, you know, I like to get back to the craft of running back play. And I've really started to, you know, become convinced of this idea that, you know, the backs who are more fundamentally sound, you know, you talk about scheme knowledge, scheme discipline, you know, processing post-snap changes, linebackers, processing offensive line leverage, making the reads quickly, you know, discipline cuts, not bouncing out when it's not supposed to be there. Those guys are really the ones that can operate when the blocking is not supreme. And, you know, last year, Saquon Barkley's blocking was not excellent by any means. The Giants offensive line was not very good, but he had that elite explosiveness. And so if there's anything that gets in the way of that elite explosion, acceleration, you know, balance, agility, he hadn't quite, and he, you know, he's actually improved in terms of his craft at running back this year. Showed some really nice gains, you know, before he had the high ankle sprain early in the year. So he has made some strides from year one to year two in that area. But, you know, when you have a high ankle sprain, it's really hard to have that top end elite explosion to where, you know, you look at his big runs last year, often he's making a guy miss by literally inches, you know, making a bounce out or a cutback. It's not necessarily how you would coach it up. And so if he can't move, you know, quite as fast as he could last year, that ends up being a tackle for a loss or a short run. And so, you know, I my hunch is that his ankle sprain, even though he's healthy enough to play, is limiting him somewhat. And then he doesn't have like the fundamental, you know, skills at running back to really, you know, grind out those 4, 5, 6, 7 yard runs through, you know, tight spaces. You know, guys who do that well, or someone like, you know, I've already talked about Dalvin Cook, like Josh Jacobs, you know, you routinely see him running through very tight spaces, you know, spaces that most running backs wouldn't even perceive there's somewhere to go. And so Saquon typically likes to see a bit of daylight, you know, whether it's where it's supposed to be or somewhere else, and then attacks that. But if he doesn't have that explosiveness, then it could be a problem.
So do you see Saquon as being a guy that could just be a lot more volatile than what folks originally thought, you know, over the course of his career? You know, because coming into this season, he was the, like we said, the clear number one pick. He's the guy, you know, most people wanted to roster despite knowing that there's probably going to be problems, you know, with the Giants offense. You know, we knew at some point Daniel Jones would be playing. We knew, you know, that their offensive line wasn't great. You know, they had made some additions through the draft the previous year with Will Hernandez, and they had, you know, made some offseason acquisitions via trade. but we knew it wouldn't be a great offensive line. And you know, you and Matt Waldman and others had talked about some of these issues with Barkley. Do you see this as potentially being something where, you know, and this isn't a good example of like a compare, I'm not trying to make a comparison here, but if you think back to Darren McFadden and how, and he was never as elite as Barkley, but he would have like this decent fantasy season and then he would just have a clunker. And it just, it seemed like there was a lot of variance, you know, in his game. And do you see that being something that could also be true with Barkley?
Yeah, I mean, I want to be clear that I and it sounds like you feel the same way. Barkley is, you know, an elite talent at running back. And he's a guy that, you know, potentially when you're talking about dynasty leagues, et cetera, you know, this offseason could be a great time to buy low, especially if he continues to play and not play up to the caliber we expect. There are a few things that I think could help him from, you know, a scheme standpoint. One would be, you know, using him as a downfield receiver a bit more. That was one of his, you know, if you recall, coming out of college, Penn State ran him downfield, you know, a decent amount, especially by college standards. You know, had some really good plays running, you know, go routes or, you know, angle routes out of the backfield. And the Giants don't really use him that way, you know, especially not this year. And his production in the passing game has decreased significantly from his rookie year. And again, some of that may be related to injury and they're trying to, you know, conserve him, but, you know, it's all just speculation. The other thing I worry about is, you know, I'm not a big fan, never have been, you know, at least thus far based on his college and early NFL tape of Daniel Jones. You know, I think he's a guy who has a lot of issues processing the field and it results in, you know, very frequent turnovers. And you've seen him, you know, throw a large number of interceptions and, you know, his fumble rate is up near the highest ever recorded for quarterbacks. So I worry about Daniel Jones being able to, you know, operate and maintain a high level NFL passing game to help open up the running lanes for Barkley. If I'm a defensive coach coming in against the Giants, you know, my goal would be to stop Barkley and, you know, dare Daniel Jones to beat us through the air.
Right. Well, so we've got another guy that's similar, you know, to Barkley, not the first overall pick, but if you've got a guy, we're going to talk about Joe Mixon now and the Bengals. This is a guy that was taken, you know, at the end of the first round or early, sometimes in the second round. Towards the end of the summer, he was starting to slip a little bit more towards the mid and late second round in a lot of the drafts that I was doing, but still a guy that, you know, fantasy owners put a decent pick into, right? You don't want your second round pick to be, you know, basically a complete miss, which at this point, you know, you may be flexing Mixon if you start a lot of players, but he's not a guy you feel really, you know, great about having in your lineup. He is the number, he's right behind Saquon Barkley. Actually, he's the number 18 running back in PPR formats. He's got 644 rushing yards. He's averaging 3.5 yards per carry. You know, he's started to pick up things as far as receiving out of the backfield over the last couple of games, but still not a lot of work there. And if you look at, you know, his yards after contact, it's 2.5 yards. You know, he's making a tackler miss on 15%, you know, of his carries. Again, that's right around, that's a little bit below the league average. But the one of the things, you know, that I like to look at, we already talked about it with Barkley, you know, are the number of carries 15 yards or over, and only 17% of his yards have come on those sort of attempts. He's only breaking a tackle. He's only breaking a carry over 15 yards on 3.3%. So slightly worse than what we've seen from Barkley. He's only gotten 108 yards off of those types of carries. But when I'm watching Mixon, and I'm interested to get your thoughts, you know, he still seems like a good runner to me. It just seems like the team is so bad. It's like, I don't know how he can overcome it. You know, it's a team that, you know, hasn't had AJ Green all year. Tyler Boyd, you know, is a slot receiver. He's not something that really demands a ton of respect. You know, they're going to get John Ross back if he can stay healthy. You know, you've had Andy Dalton out of the lineup for the last several games until this, you know, with a rookie quarterback with Ryan Finley in there. Now you get Dalton back in, but it just seems to be in the offensive line issues they've had. It seems to be kind of one thing after another. And obviously the Bengals have only won one game. So I wanted to get your thoughts on Mixon and where your head is at on him as we start thinking about him as a prospect for next season, because my gut says is that Mixon, you know, next year you probably get him as a third or fourth round pick due to recency bias. And to me, he looks like a guy that still is a decent player, but is just in a, was in a really bad situation this year.
Yeah, Dwayne, I think there's a lot to unpack with Mixon. I guess first we could start with the player. You know, I sort of think of Mixon, and my opinion of Mixon based on watching him is almost that he, you know, he's in the same mold as Saquon, maybe a poor man Saquon Barkley. You know, very good balance, agility. He's explosive, not quite as fast, not quite as explosive, or, you know, doesn't accelerate quite as well as Barkley when Barkley's healthy. But also like Saquon, you know, excellent receiver out of the backfield, ran a lot of downfield routes at Oklahoma. So he is a talented back. He doesn't necessarily have, you know, consistent discipline, consistent, excellent, you know, processing. You know, you'll see him miss reads. You'll see him miss holes occasionally, not all the time, but, you know, he's sort of middle of the pack in terms of his vision, you know, all the things that go into vision. And then, you know, you, after understanding who he is as a player, then you want to think about, you know, the surrounding talent, the surrounding scheme. Obviously the Bengals offense has been anemic, you know, one of the worst offenses in the NFL, one of the worst teams in the NFL. So they're playing from behind almost every game. You know, they just won their first game last week. They have Ryan Finley in the past several weeks who, you know, at this point in his career is not really a functional NFL quarterback. So obviously that hurts the overall offensive productivity. And so when you have a running back in a bad offense on a team that's losing a lot of games, you know, the opportunity isn't necessarily going to be there. And then their offensive line is, when, you know, when I study them, they're one of the worst offensive line units that I see on a week-to-week basis in the NFL. Routinely losing individual battles, you know, double teams that are stalemates all the time, or the defensive tackle splitting the double team. And if you're running like duo or inside zone, you know, these inside run plays where you're trying to displace the defense upfield, if you can't get a push for your double teams in combo blocks with, you know, the guard center or the guard tackle, you're going to have a lot of trouble moving the ball effectively. And it's, you know, an ongoing problem for the Bengals. So a lot of things stacked against Mixon, but, you know, situations can change. So I do think that his talent is higher than his, you know, draft position or the value, you know, the consensus value will be for him going into next season. So potentially a guy that, you know, you can buy low and, you know, he's still very young. I think he's like 22, 23 years old, came into the league young. So he should have, you know, several more years left of NFL production. And if the Bengals can improve their offensive line, you know, get Jonah Williams back, and, you know, also just use Mixon a little better situationally. I talked about his pass catching skill. I have an ongoing bit on Twitter where every week I, you know, sort of make fun of the Bengals for not using the Joe Mixon as a receiver. You know, they have Gio Bernard, but he's just not nearly as explosive in space as Mixon. And Mixon's really just running check down routes for the most part. And, you know, when he gets the ball, does well on those targets. But you'd like to see him used as a downfield receiver. So hopefully they can figure that out, get him some more production. That would obviously be huge in those PPR formats.
Well, I mean, speaking of a backfield where they're really splitting up the work, like what you talked about with Gio Bernard, I think, you know, the situation that we have to talk about, you know, for the listeners, and this is applicable as far as thinking about next year, but this also probably has pretty big implications for folks as they just think about what they're going to be doing, you know, over the next couple of weeks, you know, in their fantasy playoffs. They may be, you know, in their fantasy championship. Some folks are already, you know, some folks, you know, if you're like in leagues like what I'm in, you know, I've still got, our playoffs are just now starting. But let's talk a little bit about Chris Carson and Rashad Penny. So I think, you know, the positives here for me, Jay, you've got a team that runs the ball the sixth most in the league. They only drop back to pass. So that's not actually attempting a pass, but actually dropping back to pass 56% of the time. So they stay committed to the run. They're also running a lot more plays than what we saw from them last year. They actually run 67 plays a game, which is the sixth most in the NFL. So you've got an offense that is running a lot of plays. You've got an offense that runs the ball a lot. So it is one of the few fertile situations for where you can have two running backs actually be viable, right, from a fantasy perspective. And if you look at the last couple of weeks, so up until, you know, week 11, when the Seahawks had their bye, it had really been all about Chris Carson. You know, if I'm talking snaps here, over 70% and over 80% of the snaps almost every game. Week 10 had played 96% of the snaps. Rashad Penny had had three games where he had gotten up into the 30% range. But really, you know, outside of that, had, you know, some games where he didn't see a snap at all, was seeing 3%, 4%. Well, now you come out of the bye week. Chris Carson, 51% of the snaps versus 49% for Rashad Penny, 52% for Carson versus 47% for Rashad Penny. And what's interesting is they're using them in different ways. In week 12, Chris Carson really carried the load as far as, you know, the receiving work. He ran a route on 47% of Russell Wilson's dropbacks. Rashad Penny only did that on 25%, but Rashad Penny carried the load as far as, you know, being the runner, 54% of the carries, 31% for Chris Carson. Then last week that all flip-flopped. It was Chris Carson leading the team in the rushing attempts with 55%, Rashad Penny at 36%, you know, for the rushing, but then led the way in the passing game. He was the guy running a route on 53% of Russell Williams' dropbacks. He saw 16% of the targets, including one target in the end zone. Both players had two rushing attempts inside the 5-yard line last week. So this looks like right now, Jay, almost a 50-50 split, a very, very slight margin to Chris Carson, but really a true running back by committee. You've almost got this 1A, 1B situation going on. What are your thoughts right now around these two backs, and how confident are you in Rashad Penny being able to keep something like this up for the fantasy playoffs?
Well, Rashad Penny's another one of those guys, you know, size, speed, phenom, drafted in the first round because of, you know, his physical qualities. At San Diego State, ran in a very gap heavy scheme, and their offensive line at San Diego State was excellent. They, you know, he's often running through large gaps, and you know, he's not playing top level you know, big five power five competition at San Diego State, so he'd get against these overmatched defensive backs and, you know, give him a stiff arm, break a tackle, break off a big run, you know, so he had those high yards after contact numbers. But when he got to the NFL and the Seahawks run a fair amount of zone and, you know, duo concepts where, you know, as opposed to gap and man runs, you're not told to run to a specific place. And, you know, you have to, it's more about timing your attack through the hole on those gap runs. Instead, you have to read across, you know, 2, 3, 4 gaps, looking at the linebacker, feeling the defensive lineman, and really staying balanced so you can attack any one of those four gaps based on, you know, your processing all within, you know, 1 to 2 second window while you're working your way towards the handoff and getting up to the line of scrimmage. And Penny really struggled with this as a rookie and early this year. Recently when they played the Eagles, you know, before this past week, I broke it down on Twitter actually with a video where I was very impressed with Penny's improvement, you know, making reads, executing reads, his footwork, his ability to make, you know, secondary cuts off of his reads, both on a wide zone play and a duo play, two plays that, you know, have not been in his wheelhouse thus far. And, you know, really impressive improvement. And so I think that, you know, with his physical skills, if he can develop some of the skill set of what the Seahawks are looking for with their zone style running game, you know, he has a pretty high ceiling. And then the other thing for Chris Carson, who I also think is a very good back, you know, explosive, breaks a lot of tackles, very agile. You know, his big issue has been fumbles. He's up there at the top of the league in terms of fumbles. And when you're a running back, you know, the one thing you can't do consistently is fumble. And often that results in decreased playing time, you know, more so than any other thing as a running back. So those two things combined, I wasn't surprised that last week it was more of an even split between the two. And I wouldn't be surprised if that keeps up because I think Penny has improved, you know, pretty substantially.
That's a great breakdown. So what you're actually seeing on film is him improving in the areas that he had struggled with in the past. And one of the reasons where I know you just weren't very high on him, you know, in the preseason. So we already talked about this being an offense that could support it. So to me, that means that Penny is a guy that, you know, if you've stashed him and you've kept him all this time, you know, he's a viable, you know, flex play. I think this does bring down the ceiling for Carson. It also brings down Carson's floor on a weekly basis. Plus, to your point, if for some reason Carson, if Carson fumbles in a game, we could see even more Rashad Penny if they're starting to trust him more. So I think this is slightly bad news for Chris Carson, but you can still play him because of the way this offense works. And then Rashad Penny, you know, it's great for him. You know, if you're looking at the last couple of weeks, you know, just the raw production, you know, for the guy, he's had 15 attempts and then he's had 14 attempts. And I mean, his obviously in week 12, he had some huge plays. He had 129 yards. He had a touchdown that game. Then last week he had 74 yards. So he averaged 9 yards per carry in week 12, 4.9 yards in week 13. You know, he's avoiding, you know, quite a few tacklers. And they're getting him opportunities in the red zone and down towards the 5-yard line, like I talked about earlier, which they're also still doing for Chris Carson. So both guys, it's not like they specifically just have one role, you know, for each guy. They're using them both in a variety of ways, and it almost feels like they're interchangeable in the Seahawks game plan. So talking about another back.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're, you know, their style of play is not necessarily the same, but they're similar in terms of, you know, what they can do well in terms of running the ball and also being able to catch a little bit. So not much in terms of how they play distinguishes.
Right. So another guy that I want to make sure that we get to, we've got a few minutes left here. And I think this is a guy that you might be writing about this week for the RSP, and that is Darius Geis. So Geis, you know, this past week, obviously had a huge game, scored 2 touchdowns, had some long plays. But if you look at, you know, from a distribution standpoint, I don't know, man. This is a guy that I struggle to see how I have him actually on a couple of rosters. I'm not sure if I trust him to put him in my lineup as far as, you know, the fantasy playoffs go. I mean, it really comes down to the roster construction and what else is available. But over the last 3 weeks, 14 fantasy PPR points, 5 PPR, and then 28. But the thing that, you know, worries me, and you'll obviously get more into what you're seeing on the film with guys, but from a utilization standpoint, 30% of the snaps this past week, 36% for Chris Carson, 36% for Adrian Peterson. The week before, when Chris Thompson didn't play, it was a similar situation. Still, Wendell Smallwood saw 28% of the snaps, 41% for Geis, and 34% for Adrian Peterson. So it seems like this is a deal where Callahan is really, you know, he wants to use 3 backs right now. I think Geis obviously is the guy that shows the most explosion. Geis has gotten all 3 of the rushing attempts inside the 5 over the last 3 weeks, whereas there's 0 for Peterson or any of the other backs. So I think that's a positive for him. But if you look at routes per dropback, and he's actually, he did some okay things as a receiver in this past game, but he's really not out there a lot. You know, so only 22% of the time was he running a route, whereas Chris Thompson was running a route on 41% of those plays. Adrian Peterson, 16% of the times that Dwayne Haskins dropped back to pass, he was actually running a route. And each of the guys, Peterson had 4% of the targets, Thompson had 8%, Geis had 8%. So I'm very encouraged by what I see from Geis. Like to hear more from you on that. But as far as trusting him and inserting him in a fantasy lineup, man, I'm still just, it's a team that's not very good. We've got a rookie quarterback. They do want to run the ball, but they run the least plays. You know, we talked about Seattle being a viable spot for 2 runners. Well, this is the opposite. You've got 3 runners on a team that runs the least plays in the league, only 54 plays per game. Now they've gotten a little better over the last 3 weeks as they've gotten their feet under them a little bit. Now, some of it's been competition as well. They've played, you know, some pretty easy matchups, but they've had 62 plays, 56 plays, and 60 plays in week 11, 12, and 13. But it's just a situation for me that's a little bit tough to trust. But what are your thoughts, Jay, on Darius Geis and the rest of this Washington backfield?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you just, you know, provided a great breakdown, and I'll add to it a little bit in terms of what I saw last week, which, you know, really was one of the more exciting things that I've watched, you know, studying running backs over this year. I agree the situation is terrible, and I think, you know, really last week his production was obviously bolstered by the fact that they were playing against the worst rushing defense in the NFL in the Carolina. So don't know if his, you know, statistical success will carry over in the remaining weeks of the season. given all the limitations that you just broke down so thoroughly. But what I will say is, you know, it wasn't like Geis was just running through giant holes that his offensive line had created. There's a four-play stretch. You know, he had, I think, 13 carries. It was, you know, four of his last five carries were really just some of the more impressive stuff you'll see in terms of, you know, running back skill, the stuff that we've already talked about. I've already mentioned so much as we've gone through this episode. You know, he starts off getting his feet wet a little bit, but then as he gets his rhythm, there's a wide zone play to the right where the middle linebacker penetrates very quickly. Geis is able to go through his whole read, you know, in a very compressed time frame because of this penetration, has the balanced footwork. And again, Geis is, you know, a very big, powerful runner, but makes an excellent cutback, you know, textbook in terms of processing and reading. And, you know, it ends up being a 6-yard run only because the left guard, you know, instead of going to the second level, which he should on a wide zone, outside zone run play, he sort of stops in the cutback lane and Geis runs into him, has to go around him to get back upfield. But, you know, really an excellent run. His next carry, he runs duo, which is a block where all the linemen block down on the front side and the running back reads the middle linebacker. And essentially, you know, to simplify it a bit, wherever the middle linebacker goes, the running back is supposed to go opposite. So again, makes a perfect read. The outside linebacker has two gaps to cover. Geis approaches behind his blocker, you know, gives a jab step one way, gets the linebacker to bite, and then hits the other hole, you know, expertly manipulating that second level defender. And that's something that I really enjoy watching, something I look for in these running backs. And you see it a lot with guys who have great feet. Often the smaller guys like Dalvin Cook, you know, Philip Lindsay does this extremely well. LeSean McCoy, I posted an example of him doing that this year. You know, to see a guy like Geis do it with his, you know, physical capabilities and his power was pretty cool, because often those powerful backs just, you know, sometimes can run into contact because they're so good at picking up yards through contact. The next play, he runs a duo again, and, you know, there's not really a hole there, but he turns his shoulders, you know, reads the slightest leverage of his blockers, squeezes through the tiniest little crease, you know, gets to the second level, picks up 8 yards. And by now I'm like, man, I'm all excited. And then the next player comes up and it's, you know, his 37-yard run where they run a D-gap power play to the left side. So they pull a lineman. He's running behind a lead blocker, a lead blocking fullback, you know, gets the edge. And then a linebacker comes up and he just gives him one of the more vicious stiff arms that you'll see, you know, puts the linebacker on his back, accelerates away, runs to down to the 1 yard line. They called it a touchdown on the field, but got, you know, overturned, but then he ran it in from the 1 yard line on the next play after that. So, you know, this has me frothing at the mouth watching this. And so I think that going forward, and the big question with him is his health. But I think going forward, if he's able to stay healthy, you know, the stuff I saw this past weekend has me very excited about his potential, even in situations where, you know, he's not necessarily running behind.
Yeah,
a
player that we would love
to
see get 20 catches. I mean, 20 touches, you know, in a game, you know, versus, you know, the 10 or so, you know, that he's been getting and splitting and carrying that.
Yeah. And, you know, his pass catching, they haven't used him much like that this year, but at LSU, you know, he had very good hands, catches the ball extremely well. And Jay Gruden, actually, last offseason, his rookie year, mentioned how much better he was as a receiving back than he thought he was going to be. So I think the potential is there. You know, obviously having a guy like Chris Thompson, it's like a Gio Bernard situation in Cincinnati where that guy just has a specific role. And so, you know, as long as he's there.
Well, speaking of catching the ball, we can't just talk about runners, Jay. We got to talk about a few receivers. I know a guy that you and I talked about a lot this preseason. Well, two guys. We talked about DJ Moore and Curtis Samuel, but today we'll focus a little bit more on DJ Moore. I know there's quite a bit of hype right now surrounding DJ Moore. When you and I talked about projections early in the season, DJ Moore was the guy that I had projected to lead Carolina in targets as well as, you know, receptions, but felt there would be more big plays probably come from Curtis Samuel. And, you know, right now, I mean, that overall, that's really what we're seeing play out. But Moore is really on, you know, kind of this tear, you know, right now. And he's a popular topic. He's up to wide receiver 8 on the season. in a PPR format. So, I mean, this is a guy that's really just over the last few weeks has climbed from being down in the low 20s, the high 20s, up into, you know, really being into the top 10 fantasy wide receivers. If you look at his work over the last several weeks, week 11, 18 PPR points, week 12, 31, then 19 PPR points in week 13. He's now averaging 17 points per game on the season. Obviously, he's a guy that's out on the field all the time. He's seeing a lot of targets, though, 30%, 22%, 26% over the last 3 weeks. He's also all of a sudden seeing a lot of targets in the end zone, which was something that I know you and I specifically talked about, and it was a concern for you with DJ Moore. And that, you know, Curtis Samuel up to this point in the year had led the team in those end zone targets. But now DJ Moore, he has 6 on the season, but he has 5 over the last 3 games. He's got 5 targets in the end zone. So, and this is a player also that, you know, Jay, we've seen his average depth of target really move up. Last year, you know, you were talking 8-9 yard range. Over the last 3 weeks, 11.5, 14.3, 12.8. So not deep down the field, but more in the intermediate space, not just shallow underneath crosser kind of stuff. He's doing some different things, you know, which is helping him from an air yards perspective. You know, Curtis Samuel, on the other hand, last week, 17.4. So he's still stretching the field more than DJ Moore. But if you look at it on the season, Moore's right at a 12 and Curtis Samuel's right at a 15.5. What are you seeing with DJ Moore and, you know, with this breakout, you know, really over the last 3 to 4 weeks where he's become so viable as a fantasy starter?
Well, DJ Moore is interesting because, you know, you and I have talked a lot about sort of the breadth of application of receivers, you know, how many things can they do well? And he's really a guy that is excellent, you know, in over a small domain of receiver play, you know, probably elite in that area. And so when he's in an offense that allows him to do what he's good at and that features those skills that he's good at, he's a guy that can produce, you know, substantial numbers, which is what we see this year. And, you know, in terms of getting specific on his strengths, you know, I don't think anyone would disagree with the fact that he's extremely quick. You know, he has great lateral agility. He's a strong player. You know, on those underneath routes, he's aggressive to the ball, catches it well, even with contact, you know, on like a quick slant or, you know, a 10-yard curl, something like that. And then after the catch, he runs very aggressively, breaks a lot of tackles, you know, becomes a running back once he has the ball in his hands. And so typically where you see him have success is on in-breaking routes like the slants, you know, the digs, the 10, 15-yard in-breaking routes, curls, you know, wide receiver screens. And what he doesn't necessarily do as well are the downfield routes, you know, the deep posts, deep, you know, just go routes, fades. You know, I still haven't seen him really make an easy catch over the shoulder. He tends to try to turn around and catch the ball with his chest towards the quarterback, and sometimes that can cause trouble on those downfield targets where you really, you know, want to adjust your speed so you can run through the catch and catch it over your shoulder. And I think that having a quarterback like Kyle Allen, who really struggles with his accuracy down the field, you know, actually helps DJ Moore when you're talking about having Curtis Samuel on the other side of him as the number one and number two receiver, because the Panthers really use Curtis Samuel, and, you know, he's faster than Moore in terms of straight line speed. They use Curtis Samuel to run a lot of vertical routes to take the tops off the defense. And Samuel draws a lot of attention, you know, often draws the defense's number one corner, you know, often runs into safety coverage where he is attracting two defenders. And so it opens up the underneath routes for Moore, who is then, you know, targeted by a quarterback who prefers to throw the underneath stuff anyway. And so that's why, you know, DJ Moore ends up with so many targets, and he's good at executing those targets and producing with the targets that he gets. My only concern is that as, you know, you move forward, if you have changes in coordinators, you have changes in quarterbacks, you know, if the scheme or the personnel fit doesn't favor that playing style anymore, you could potentially have a career like Golden Tate where, you know, some years he produces excellent numbers, but some years he's essentially nowhere to be found. And, you know, Tate is my comparison for Moore. And I actually think Tate, you know, while he's not quite as quick and maybe not quite as explosive as Moore, you know, Tate is a guy who does well underneath and runs like a running back after the catch. But I think he tracks the ball a little bit better than Moore does down the field. So even potentially
just for the folks listening that may be thinking dynasty, you know, here,
do DJ Moore.
Whenever you, you know, and we'll often hear, you know, Matt talk about this, you know, the ease of fix, right, of certain traits. When you talk about tracking the ball down the field, hand positioning, and some of the things that you talked about with Moore on deeper throws, is that typically an easy fix, you know, for a wide receiver? Is it a medium type fix, or is it something that if it's a challenge for them in college and they haven't gotten it by now, it's typically something that you just won't see, you know, improve?
Well, you know, improvement is different for any athlete. And I think when a player is having great success overall, you know, putting up good numbers, being very productive, you're less likely to look at your game critically. And, you know, there are unique individuals who will have success and still look to improve. But I think that it produces less of an inclination to try to work on your game. So I haven't seen DJ Moore show great improvement on the weaknesses that he's had dating back to Maryland, you know, the downfield game, the over-the-shoulder throws, you know, high-pointing the ball, making downfield catches with contestment. So, you know, and I think tracking the ball is probably one of the harder things to improve as a receiver because it's, I don't even know, I mean, you can work on it, but, you know, it just seems that some receivers have it, some receivers don't, and I haven't seen guys make great strides with that. But, you know, with other weaknesses in his game, you know, I think that another thing that I didn't mention earlier is that when he runs his routes, I did mention that he likes to turn and have his chest to the quarterback. You know, when he breaks, he'll have a good break. He'll get separation at the break point, but often then he'll turn and look for the ball and slow down a bit. And that's, it's actually good to do that against zone coverages because he'll find holes in the zone that way and, you know, make eye contact with the quarterback and get targets. But you'll see against man that he gets immediate separation and then it closes. He had an end zone target this week where he ran a slant and the corner's in press coverage and he gets him, you know, with his release and his break and there's separation at the break. But then as Kyle Allen goes to throw it, Moore slows down and the corner's able to undercut the route, nearly picks it off in the end zone. And, you know, this was on their goal line stand where they lost the game at the very end of the game there. So something like that is a bit easier to work on where it's more about, you know, fundamentals and unlearning bad habits as opposed to ball tracking and being able to attack the ball, which is a very complex, right. Cognitive.
So from a perspective, let me just ask you this real quick. And then if there's another receiver you want to hit on, I know we mentioned a few before the show. We've got about, you know, we've got 3 or 4 minutes left here. From a DJ Moore perspective, sure.
Well, let me talk about his counterpart a little bit more, Curtis Samuel. Obviously, a guy that I like, you know, have liked going back to this offseason when I really studied his game. He's someone that if the Panthers are able to upgrade their quarterback position, especially a quarterback that can throw the ball downfield accurately, he's a guy that could see a real leap in production. I think, you know, statistically, both Moore and Samuel are up at the top of the list for off-target downfield passes. But when you watch Samuel, he's actually really adept at playing these balls. You know, he's often in a lot of traffic, so they haven't had a lot of success when you talk about the defensive approaches and then also the inaccurate passes. But if he's able to hook up with a quarterback who can throw well downfield, I would expect his production to take off more than DJ Moore's production and potentially could eat into Moore's production if they have a quarterback who's willing to take more downfield throws as opposed to,
we have seen that actually
slants or the,
and we've seen that all, and we've already seen that this year. So I mean, if you, there have been periods where really Curtis Samuel has been the lead target on the team. And a lot of this stuff, you know, we've talked about this a little bit before. I certainly talk about this a lot with Brian Drake on the Fantasy Football Hustle. But defenses are looking at typically the last 3 to 4 games, right? When they're studying and getting ready for an opponent. So a lot of times you'll see these ups and downs for, you know, certain weapons in an offense, especially if it's an offense that's willing to be balanced. You know, there's certain offenses, and you've talked about this, where the design is going to be there. They're going to get their targets no matter what, like Michael Thomas. But a situation like Carolina, you know, you've had multiple weeks where DJ Moore has actually led the team, you know, in targets. You know, he led the team in targets in week 3. He led the team in targets in week 4. Then he led the team in targets again week 7. You know, so we've seen, you know, out of the gate, it was DJ Moore the first 2 weeks. Then the next 2 weeks, it was, you know, Curtis Samuel. So I agree with you. I would expect, you know, and I actually talked about this on the Fantasy Football Hustle podcast a couple of weeks ago, that I'm expecting Curtis Samuel to see, you know, he should see improved production here, you know, eventually. So I'm thinking for folks in the fantasy playoffs, I don't know that it necessarily comes at how much it will come at the expense of DJ Moore, but I still feel good about Curtis Samuel, very similarly, you know, to you. So I think that's a really great point that you brought up around Samuel. One last thing. So, excuse me. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. I feel better if they have.
I'm with you on that one for sure, too. And we'll have to see what happens, you know, with Cam Newton or what they do at quarterback. But real quickly, you know, before we jump, I know there's a couple of other receivers we talked about. You know, we won't have time to get to all of them. But is there a certain other receiver you just want to hit on real quick for folks before we, you know, have to sign off for the night? Well, yeah,
I don't have anyone in mind. Is there someone that you want to talk
about? But I just find it to be fascinating. A guy that's been in the league this long, had so much promise, had shown so much, and really we've just never seen it all click for him. We've seen slight glimpses of what a guy like him could do. And now, you know, all of the sudden with Ryan Fitzpatrick, you know, we're talking about a guy that actually people can feel very comfortable from a fantasy perspective, which I just really didn't think you would be saying this year. This is a guy that I had really just completely at this point written off. But I mean, here are his fantasy points each week: 11, 9, 17, 12, 17, 12, 16, 12, 21, 15, 35. I mean, that, you know, that's pretty salty. I think he's like number 21 right now, in rankings for fantasy. This is a guy that wasn't even drafted in most drafts. So just, if you have anything, any closing thoughts on Devontae Parker, I think that would be great.
Yeah, you know, I haven't studied him in great depth this year, but Devontae Parker has always been, you know, a very good athlete, good at playing the ball, contested catches, you know, but a little less refined in his releases, his route running. So when you pair him with a guy like Ryan Fitzpatrick, who is a risk taker at the quarterback position, you know, it's like the cast-offs of the NFL and the fantasy, you know, the fantasy football world. But they're a really good fit together because Fitzpatrick is willing to throw the ball up in a one-on-one situation and you know, trust the receiver to come down with it. And Parker's been able to capitalize on that, you know, pretty consistently this year. So it seems like a good fit in terms of skill set. And, you know, they're in situations where they're often losing. Their offense has actually been producing pretty well these past few weeks. So, you know, potentially, you know, waiver wire ad midseason that could end up
that'll be it for
winning teams championships. And it's funny because every offseason he's had
like, just forget it.
League winner hype. I know. And this is the one offseason where everybody gave up on him. And, you know, of course.
Great breakdowns as usual tonight. So hopefully folks enjoyed, you know, us bringing the data together, you know, with the film. That's what we do. We're very appreciative to Matt Waldman for allowing us this platform on the RSP. Obviously, you know, if you guys haven't checked out Matt's work, you absolutely should. If you like what you're hearing from us, you know, what you're going to get from Matt's even better. So until next. Yeah.
Yeah, Dwayne, I just saw the other day that Matt has started offering his publication, the 2020 Rookie Scouting Portfolio. I'm sure most of the listeners are familiar with it, but, you know, goes into astonishing detail on a huge number of prospects at the skill positions. You know, probably the prime scouting, you know, publication for those of you in dynasty leagues looking to get ready for your rookie drafts. So that's available for purchase now. He usually sends it out I think, you know, around March, April of 2020, before the draft. So, you know, yeah, really absolutely. High quality, I mean, production I can't, there. So honestly, definitely look into that if you haven't
already. I can't
already.
Say enough about it. I can't think of another resource where I've learned as much as what I've learned from the RSP over the past, you know, almost 10 years that I've been reading it. You know, and just the fact that we get to come on here and do this on, you know, this platform, it's amazing. You know, honestly, sometimes I'm just kind of like, wow, I can't believe we're actually doing this because I know you feel the same way because you love Matt's work and you know how much work goes into, you know, grading these prospects and the amount of detail, like you said, that he goes into. You just learn so much, not just about the players in that year, but just about the game. The way the game works, you know, all of the nuances, you know, and Matt has a really strong process and the way that he, and it's in this an iterative process that he continues to refine and he walks the readers through what he's done there. So, I mean, you get to go as deep as you want to go into a mind, you know, that is locked on this stuff, you know, for the full season. So, yeah, absolutely. If you guys haven't had a chance to order yet, you should. We appreciate you guys listening. The downloads and stuff have been great. Jay and I are very, you know, excited about the way this is going, and good luck to everybody in your fantasy playoffs, unless you happen to be playing myself or Jay. So we'll talk to you next time.